Thousands of years have gone by since Adam and Eve's first sin, when God gave them a promise of a Savior who would win. Words from the Baby King, Concordia Publishing House's new Christmas arch book. The Baby King would make a great Christmas gift for children, grandchildren, and godchildren ages 5 through 9. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, The Baby King. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, everyone was watching it for a number of reasons. Some were watching it because they were worried about the complexion of the U.S. Senate. Others were concerned about the possible election of a man who may have credibly been charged with, well, some very strange sexual preferences and behavior earlier in his life, or may have lied about those things or come to lie about them. In the end, Roy Moore lost his bid for the Senate seat from Alabama. How has the media covered that race, and how have they covered the outcome, especially who voted for whom and why? Joining us to talk about media coverage of evangelical voters and the Alabama Senate race, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
I was reading what you had to say about this, your analysis of the media coverage, and I kind of had to rub my eyes for a second because I thought I read you saying that the New Yorker had the best coverage of the Alabama race. Are you trying to say that the New Yorker understands evangelical Protestants better than the rest of the press?
Well, that's specifically what this New Yorker piece was about, and that's what shocked me, because in the midst of just a tsunami of coverage that basically blamed Moore completely on the white evangelical Protestant vote, you know, and where have we heard that again in the past year and a half or so? The New Yorker actually sent a reporter down there named Benjamin Wallace-Wells, who talked to a very large number of evangelicals and noted several things. First of all, he opened with a letter that the Moore campaign had sent out claiming the endorsement of 50 Alabama pastors, and research had shown that this letter had all kinds of strange things about it. First of all, it was a letter from a couple of years earlier, before the scandal with the sexual improprieties had surfaced. A lot of the names on the list couldn't be found, or in one embarrassing case was no longer a minister. He was now a real estate agent. But here's the big thing that the New Yorker got that I don't think I've seen anybody else really dig into until here now at the last minute after the election, a story in the New York Times. He focused on the fact that major evangelical leaders in the state of Alabama, and specifically this little tiny organization called the Southern Baptist Convention, which is fairly important in Alabama life, he couldn't find a single major Southern Baptist leader in the state of Alabama who had endorsed Moore or who had done so openly. Then he got into the very prominent evangelical names who had just blasted Moore with some of the most pointed and harsh condemnations, whereas most of the evangelicals who were supporting him were from smaller churches. They were kind of like off the beaten track people who didn't have a very high profile in Alabama life, religious or political. So anyway, it surprised me that it was the New Yorker that did the best job of breaking down the stereotype that evangelicals are some sort of political monolith, even when facing a race in which the Democrats put up a candidate who, as I put it, was basically a member of the Planned Parenthood All-Star team. Can you imagine what this race would have been like if, just to pick a stereotype or a set of conditions out of the hat, how would this race have been, how would it have unfolded if the Democrats had nominated a female African-American pro-lifer?
Very differently.
I mean, I think Moore gets slaughtered in that kind of a scenario. Or at the very least, the margin would have been much greater. And I guarantee you, you would have seen significant white evangelical crossover, even more than what happened if you had had such a candidate, if they had run even a moderate on that issue, on the abortion issue. Or if, let's say they ran a Democrat who was willing to take a very strong stand on conscience clauses related to religious liberty or something like that. Anything to show a kind of Southern Democrat profile from the old days, I think Moore would have been just bulldozed at that point. In fact, if there was a chance that the Democrats were going to run such a candidate, I think Republicans would have done more to try to knock or force Moore out. It would have been a completely different race all around. As it was, I argued in a post earlier this week at Get Religion that the evangelical response to the Moore crisis, which the subject of very good articles by Sarah Pulliam Bailey at the Washington Post, as you would expect, a great article at Christianity Today by Jeremy Weber. You're not surprised to see people like that getting it, you know, in coverage of the election. But for something as prominent as The New Yorker to actually have the most interesting, insightful piece on divisions among evangelicals and the diversity of voices within evangelicalism, that had to count as some sort of major surprise. And thus, this article probably reached a completely different kind of reader, I hope, including a lot of, frankly, elite-level journalists.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of evangelical voters and the Alabama Senate race when we come back. Was it, as some have suggested, the New South beating out the Old South?
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical confessional Christianity and Lutheranism, and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Christ Lutheran is a welcoming congregation in Rochester, Minnesota, providing traditional liturgy and hymns, word and sacraments. Call 507-289-0271. That's 507-289-0271. Or visit ChristRochester.org. Christ Lutheran Church, receiving and sharing Christ's mercy.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Give the gift of time this Christmas with a gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Call toll-free 1-866-827-0062 or visit thecleaningauthority.com. A happy wife is a happy life. A Christmas gift certificate from your favorite house cleaning service, The Cleaning Authority, 866-827-0062 or thecleaningauthority.com.
This Christmas, bring your family and friends to experience a reenactment of the Christmas story and Journey to the Manger, an interactive Christmas experience.
Enjoy a live nativity, warm drinks and cookies, and live music performed by student groups.
From 5 to 8 p.m. on December 22nd, come to Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, to enjoy this Christmas experience for all ages.
Admission is free, and when you donate $25 or more, you'll receive a custom piece of art made by our students.
For more information,
call 618-656-0043.
Merry Christmas!
Just looking at the raw data, we see that in each cycle, embryos are lost along the way. I don't understand how you could even call that a pro-life approach to making babies.
We're drawing the biblical distinction between justification and sanctification. So Lutheranism is about being faithful to the biblical witness in both. And they are distinct.
It's a form of theological robbery that steals away every blessing that the Lord wants us to have and replaces it with this tinfoil, tinsel, fake, plastic nonsense.
Each one of us, all 7 billion, all have these magical divine destinies from forever where we're all going to change the world.
That's just a taste of what 1 hour from now you're going to be hearing in their entirety, the 4 sound bites that we are going to be playing for you when we play Issues, Etc. sound bite of the week. You'll get a chance to win the LPR bundle package. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Issues, Etc. travel mug, pen, bumper sticker, and notepad. It goes to the listener with the best vote for Issues, Etc. sound bite of the week when we play 1 hour from now. In the meantime, Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about how the media has covered evangelical voters, especially with respect to the Alabama Senate race. I got a question. This one is raised by a piece that David French recently wrote in National Review Online, where he basically said the Alabama race was the new South beating out the old South. What do you make of that, Terry?
Well, first of all, it's much like the debates within the Southern Baptist Convention. It should be apparent to anybody who followed Southern Baptist life over the last couple of years that one of the fastest growing segments of Southern Baptist life has been African American and Latino churches. In fact, without the growth of those segments of the denomination, I think the Southern Baptist would be having more statistical problems than they're having now. The other thing is that among younger Southern Baptist pastors, instead of, some people might think younger people, they're going to be less conservative. In many ways, the young Southern Baptist world is just as conservative or more conservative as always. You have an interesting wrinkle in that a lot of them are Calvinist in expression. But without getting into the theological niceties here, suffice it to say they're young and they're conservative, but they're just not as interested in politics at the level of thinking that you can vote in the kingdom. They don't accept a kind of religious right mechanism that if we elect X number of Republicans, we can vote the kingdom in at the level of the Supreme Court. These young Southern Baptists, let's call them the New South Southern Baptists, are much more interested in culture. They're much more interested, frankly, in church growth and evangelism at the level of a diverse model of church life as opposed to just big suburban megachurches. So I think he's talking about the young South, the new South, just as much in terms of Southern Baptist life and evangelical life, and also this generational difference that we saw in the battles over Trump, where most of the people who strongly came out endorsing Trump, the vast majority of the evangelicals who did that were quite frankly old, They were the old guard of that religious right model approach to public life and the civic square, as opposed to the people who were specifically, like a David French, people who were anti-Trump, but also they were never Trump and they were never Hillary at the same time. They were arguing that in the end, you don't have to do evil in order to defeat evil. So they argued for voting for third parties. They argued that in some case, the wisest thing you could do is stay home. Now, when you look at how evangelicals responded to the Alabama crisis, in my post, I came up with a series of bullet items describing how I read the evangelical options after reading that New Yorker piece. Let me run through them really, really quickly. I think it's very important to realize that there were evangelicals who backed Moore from the beginning, and they were crucial, much like the evangelicals who backed Trump enthusiastically. They were crucial to his primary vote. But you don't win the general election with just them, right? And Trump obviously gained, some people would say 50% of his evangelical voters came on in the general election because they had no choice if they were going to vote against Hillary. Okay, so first we have the pro-Moore evangelicals. Second, we have a lot of evangelicals in Alabama who wanted other conservative candidates, but then forced with Moore as the nominee, some of them like sort of reluctantly backed him, and others just silently said, okay, I'm going to have to do this. Number three, there were evangelicals who openly opposed Moore, always did, always wanted him not to be the candidate. But when it came to the election and they're forced with either voting for him or Doug Jones, they silently voted for Moore, even though they didn't think he was qualified. Just like I know lots of people who did not think Donald Trump was qualified to be president of the United States. But on election day, they voted for him, simply because they believed they had no other choice. Now, then you had another group of people in Alabama. This sounds like the 2016 race again. They couldn't vote for Moore, so they wrote in a third-party option. The most significant number, according to David French, in some very lively exchanges with Daniel Burke of CNN on Twitter, French thinks the single most important evangelical response to the Moore crisis in Alabama was the percentage of people who appear to have stayed home. And he argues the key statistic is that when you compare the election, the Trump election 2016, with the number of votes cast in the current election, Moore got fewer than half of the 1.3 million votes that Trump did. And French basically argues that somewhere between 40 and 50% of evangelicals appear to have stayed home. Now, of course, off-year elections always have smaller turnouts, but he notes that Jones got about 90% of the Hillary votes from 2016, but that Trump got less than half of the 1.3 million Trump votes in Alabama. He said a lot of people stayed home and didn't vote. And French argues that this has to be seen as one of the primary evangelical responses to the Moore candidacy. And then finally, to round out my whole typology, you did have some white evangelicals who simply in the end felt they had to vote for Jones, that they had to vote for some sort of significant change, in large part out of a sense of unity or solidarity with African-American evangelicals and African-American church leaders. Now, did you see any kind of complexity like that in most of the coverage that you read about Alabama?
Oh, no, no, no. No, not at all.
I mean, we're still seeing phrases that basically says white evangelicals in Alabama overwhelmingly wanted Moore. I mean, we're still seeing that pretty consistently. And I think there are significant number of evangelicals who backed Moore from the beginning, but I would argue that at the very least, there is evidence that white evangelicals in Alabama split down the middle, 50-50 or so. And it's also significant that even if that write-in total, the most visible form of protest, so to speak, even if that write-in total was rather small, only like 2% or 2.1 or whatever it ended up being, it was enough votes to cost Moore the election. So there was a lot to talk about here. But the last thing I felt the press should have come out of Alabama with is more evidence that there was some sort of political monolith called white evangelicalism. I just don't know how you get that out of this story.
Do you expect, because everyone's looking for this kind of teased out analysis here, it was obviously important for some reason, and usually since the press is completely and utterly obsessed largely with Donald Trump, this has to mean something about him too. And he did in the end, at kind of the last hour, endorse Roy Moore.
Yeah.
Do you think the rest of the press will look at something like what the New Yorker has done and say, ah, okay, that's a good detailed analysis, or is it just easier to stick with the monolithic view of white evangelicals?
Well, it's significant that the New York Times, even though they ran it after the election and made it sound like a lot of the evangelical debates about Moore, the New York Times kind of made it sound like this was a reaction to Moore losing, that because he lost, we now have this crisis of conscience among evangelicals and they're arguing with each other. The Times could have written the exact same article about Moore and the debates about him among evangelicals. They could have written the same article 3 months ago or 6 months ago. And the article, frankly, would have been a lot more prophetic. But the fact that you now have the New Yorker and the New York Times both putting at least some of these alternative evangelical voices into play is significant. However, I do think right now that media, mainstream media anger about Trump is so great and so fierce that we still have this situation where they have to have someone to blame for Trump. And white evangelicals seem to be the chosen boogeyman. And why do you think the press is so reluctant to portray a more complex view of evangelical Protestantism?
Well, I'll think about that during the break, and we'll come back to that on the other side. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Folks, Christmas is 10 days away. It's not too late to order The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month, The Baby King, for your child, your grandchild, godchild, or the youngsters participating in your church's Christmas program. The Baby King is for children ages 5 through 9. It costs only $2.99, and if you spend more than $49, you'll get free shipping from Concordia Publishing House. Look for The Baby King at issuesetc.org. or call CPH at 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. When we come back, well, why are they reluctant to be more accurate about that? It's hard to remember, frankly, what the press's problem with white evangelicals was before Donald Trump came along. Stay tuned.
Tough to be Lutheran in America these days. Our families, our schools and churches, even our most deeply held beliefs and values are under fire. We need unchanging truth in a world full of confusion. The Lutheran Witness magazine can help. For less than a quarter a day, get the best of Lutheran reflection on faith and life, theology and culture, delivered monthly right to your mailbox. Learn more at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During December, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to our Ministry of the Month, Ministry Focus. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
We have 3 weeks left in 2017, and we need $75,000 to cover our projected expenses for the year. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues, etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2017. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about how the media has covered evangelical voters in the Alabama Senate race. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Terry, before the break, you asked why I thought the media was reluctant to portray a more nuanced picture of evangelical voters. Frankly, it's difficult to remember what the press's problem was with evangelical voters before Donald Trump came along.
Well, I think you're onto something there. Part of it to me is to stop and think about these newsrooms themselves. Why aren't they blaming Trump primarily on conservative Catholics? Well, part of the reason is that the Catholic vote has always been so diverse, and the number of conservative Catholics as a percentage of American Catholics is so small. I mean, the statistic you've heard me use in the past, only about 4% of American Catholics go to confession. So how large is the camp of conservative Catholics? Well, so there are probably, in both all the newsrooms I worked in, there were quite a few liberal Catholics. So you're not going to blame Catholics. Well, then why don't they blame Orthodox Jews? Well, first of all, there's not that many Orthodox Jews. Yet when you deal your typical elite newsroom, you do have quite a few cultural Jews from the Northeast and from elite higher education ranks, etc. Well, why aren't they blaming Muslims? Well, there aren't that many Muslims, but I guarantee you that any Muslims who are in these elite newsrooms are not moral and social conservatives. So when you end up, who isn't in the newsroom?
Well, the white evangelicals.
White evangelicals, for the most part, are not in that newsroom, which means to some degree, there aren't even liberal evangelicals in the newsroom, in many cases, to say, wait a minute, guys, we should at least call these other voices. I mean, there's not even a liberal Southern Baptist who's left and gone somewhere else who still knows, well, look, that's just some of the Baptists. You need to look at these others. There just aren't people in these newsrooms with the journalistic background to realize that these stories just don't ring true. Obviously, someone like a Jeremy Weber at Christianity Today or a Sarah Pulliam Bailey, you know, at the Washington Post are exceptions to this. And there's, you know, the fine religion writer at the New York Times. I disagree with some of the things that Goodstein does, but I still would say that she's sitting there knowing who these other voices are on Twitter. So once again, I think what we have here is a vision into the problem of the media's coverage of religion in general, which is when you don't have a diverse intellectual and cultural set of voices in the newsrooms, and you don't have someone like Lori Goodstein at the Times, who's been covering this beat for years, and they're not following the diverse evangelical debates on Twitter, you just get simplistic coverage. And there's nobody sitting there on the copy desk or in the glass box editor suites around the edge of the room. There's no one there to say, hey, what about these people? Hey, Al Mohler is a huge voice in American evangelicalism at the elite higher educational level and within the Southern Baptist Convention. What's he saying about Moore? What's he saying about Trump? And in both cases, of course, he was opposed to their candidacies the whole time. You couldn't get away with the simplistic coverage of evangelicals if you had a more diverse set of reporters and editors in the newsrooms. And you know me well enough to know I'm going to blame evangelicals in part for that, because evangelicals as a segment of our society, at the higher educational level even, have written off journalism for decades. Remember, we had that argument the other day, or not an argument. You and I were not arguing. We were just lively conversing. How much have Missouri Synod Lutherans contributed to the world of journalism at the level of higher education? Maybe that's another issue that people need to approach the leaders of conservative denominations like the Southern Baptist Convention and the Missouri Synod Lutherans and the Presbyterian Church in America and, you know, similar groups. You need to walk up and say, are our schools doing anything to produce young people who can go into these newsrooms and be alternative sources of telephone numbers, website URLs, additional sources of valid journalistic information to make the coverage more complex and nuanced? Obviously, I think that's something we've got to do at some point, or we just give up.
To reference David French one more time, rapidly becoming someone I have to read every day, he observed something about Roy Moore. He wrote a piece where he said, for the sake of argument, let's just lay aside the allegations related to his previous sexual dalliances and look at his record as a judge in Alabama. And he said he essentially forcefully argued, even if there weren't these allegations that put him back in the headlines, he's still disqualified to serve as a senator because he has defied the higher court of his state and the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said that alone should have disqualified him from serious consideration. Why am I reading that from a conservative and not from, that's an easy case to make? Why wasn't I reading that in the New York Times?
Yeah, I mean, the man's a target-rich environment like Trump. You don't need to make up stuff to be able to attack Judge Moore. And remember, David French is a Harvard Law School-level legal mind, yet someone who was on to the issue of religious liberty cases being a crucial cutting edge of American life. Way more than a decade ago, he began working on those issues and focusing. He's not saying that it's a problem if someone wants to criticize the American regime on abortion or religious liberty or whatever. He's saying Moore flatly rejected the structures of American law, and in doing so, was attacking the Constitution, not defending it. And then there's dozens of other crazy things about Moore, and not to mention the fact that you did have those Washington Post stories, which the timing I thought was a little bit suspicious, waiting until after Moore had the nomination. But the Washington Post stories about the strangeness of his love life, shall we say, not to mention what seemed to be documented cases of assault or ephebophilia, you didn't have to make stuff up to attack Moore. Moore was not a mainstream conservative candidate for the Senate, period. How did he get where he got?
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
When we come back on this Friday afternoon, Pastor Chris Rosebrough joins us. It's This Week in Pop American Christianity. We're going to hear some examples of what he's calling Wonder Woman and Aladdin prophecies. Then we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Here's what you'll find in the latest Issues Etc. journal. I've written a column titled A Letter to Ex-Evangelicals. Pastor Rob Kieslowski has detailed his journey to the Lutheran Christian tradition, and Dr. Ken Sherb writes about the story of an entire city's journey to the Reformation, Strasbourg, France. We'll send you the Issues Etc. journal for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org, the free online Issues Etc. journal.